Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So super excited with the guests that we have joining us today. We're going to be talking about building, scaling, financing and all the above, all the good stuff that we like to hear. He's done it multiple times and very successfully so. So again, without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Rajiv Khemani. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Alejandro, for having me on this show. It's a pleasure to be here. And thank you again for inviting me to Dealmakers.
So originally born in India, Rajiv, give us a little of a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up there?
Life in India was very good. I've been very blessed with a great family. My father was a senior official in the Indian government, would get transferred from place to place. So I was born in the western state of Gujarat in India. I lived for several years in the northern part in Himachal, which is close to the Himalayas. But did my high schooling and college in New Delhi, where made a lot of friends and finished my undergraduate degree in computer science at the IIT in New Delhi. So all in all, it was just tremendous. I have fond memories of growing up in India.
Now, in your case, you know, obviously the career, you know, one thing led to the next, and then all of a sudden you find yourself in the United States, you know, the American dream, the land of opportunity. You were going after your PhD at NYU. So how was that transition coming here and seeing all the opportunity around you in such a city like New York City?
Yeah, so New York was the very first time I left India. So it was the first time I'm coming to the U.S., the first time I was leaving India. You know, New York City is a fascinating place, lots and lots of people, lots of activity all around. So in many ways, actually, it's similar to India. India's got a lot of people, as you know. And NYU in downtown New York City is just an amazing place with the campus that's part of the city. So I came here. It was good fun. You know, I was excited to be part of the PhD program. What turned out was I did a couple of years at NYU. And finished my master's. And I came to the conclusion I was more interested in applied stuff rather than theoretical stuff. And I wanted to get some industry experience. And then, you know, I left New York to go to California and never went back. So I got my master's at NYU. But again, NYU was a great, great time and learned a lot and made lots of good friends.
I mean, you definitely have come to the United States and, you know, took a piece out of every, you know, incredible university. I mean, NYU, then Stanford. I mean, in Stanford, you were doing more of the business side. Is that right?
You know, after I came to California, Silicon Valley, which is really the mecca of all technology, I started out as a software engineer at a company called Sun Microsystems, which was a hot Unix workstation company and server company. Really was the foundation of internet infrastructure. As I was doing that, I got interested in talking to customers, explaining, communicating the technology and the value proposition of the technology. And I wanted to move into the sales and marketing side. I tried to get into sales and marketing at Sun, but they said I was very technical and needed a little more business background, if you will. And so I applied to business school and was, again, fortunate to be selected at Stanford University, where I did my MBA. And that really allowed me to interact with some of the leading entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley, allowed me to, again, build great friendships with folks in my class, and then go back to Sun Microsystems into more of a product management type of a role.
I mean, obviously, you did a little bit more of the corporate side of things, but then eventually you ended up launching your first company, NetBoost. So how did the whole idea of NetBoost come about? I mean, you were coming from India. You know, in India, there's a lot of pressure around getting the best studies, working at the best companies, and you had accomplished that, you know, NYU, Stanford, Sun Microsystems. But then all of a sudden you decide that it's time to take the leap of faith. So walk us through the different sequence of events that needed to happen for you to be comfortable with heading into the unknown.
You know, my education at Stanford really influenced me a lot. I had the opportunity to take a bunch of classes from leading venture capitalists. I took a class from Andy Grove, who used to be the CEO of Intel at the time, and got really familiar with, you know, met with a lot of successful entrepreneurs. You know, I certainly met with Scott McNeely and Vinod Khosla at that time. And I was really fascinated by how people could create companies and make them successful. And so there were a number of, I would say, role models or people that inspired me to do something like this. But having said that, I look at my career more as a lot of friendships, relationships, and then serendipity. So the how NetBoost got started, and I didn't found NetBoost. But I was working at NetApp, and we did the very first acquisition that NetApp ever did, a company called Internet Middleware. And the CEO of that company did not join NetApp, and he went and founded NetBoost. And he called me several months later, and he said, "Hey, would you like to come work for us?" And, you know, so I applied the formula that has worked well for me since then, which is, you know, go with and work with people that you know. Go work with excellent teams. A lot of the folks at NetBoost were from Sun Microsystems. You know, one of my Stanford friends was an investor in NetBoost. And so that kind of gave me the confidence to jump into it. And it was also an exciting time. Internet was early, and NetBoost was trying to build what really became as a category called network processor. And NetBoost was one of the pioneers in that space. And so that was also very exciting. So all of those combined got me to jump into my very first startup.
What employee number were you at NetBoost?
I was, don't remember exactly, but I was, you know, it was a very small company, not around for a long time. It's probably in the, you know, in the 10 or so, something like that.
I mean, it's still considered intrapreneurship, you know, because you took that leap of faith too of joining a tiny company, you know, from what you were used to. But, you know, in this case, you know, the company ended up, you know, achieving a really nice outcome. You know, it was acquired by Intel for about $225 million, you know, which I'm sure that gave you visibility into what the full cycle of a company looks like. So what visibility did that give you into that?
Well, it was interesting to build a disruptive product from scratch. It wasn't a category that existed. It was this idea that in order for internet to achieve its full potential, it needed to go faster. And it needed to become much more secure. And I think that was an important aspect. And so it was kind of going and trying to figure out which customers would care about it. Would they be enterprises? Would they be system companies? You know, talking to customers, figuring out the product definition. So that was a big learning through that process. And then once we became part of Intel, all of a sudden you go from being a little startup with not a lot of resources to a company that has tremendous resources and an infrastructure in terms of not just capital, but also the brand and the sales and marketing channels. So it was, you know, it was a good transition.
And then you were at Intel, you know, for about 5 years, and then, you know, it was time to turn page. So what was the next chapter?
Again, through same theme that you'll see again and again, which is through certain connections. I got connected to Cavium. It was great to see Cavium had a great team. You know, it was the DEC Alpha team, bunch of very smart folks from Cisco. And it was funded by some good investors. So I joined as the very first VP of marketing at Cavium. And again, the idea was what Cavium was trying to do was it was, again, similar theme, infrastructure focused on networking and security applications. but really trying to do it in a very innovative fashion. And so it was, again, seemed very attractive. I saw the Cavium, I met the Cavium team, very impressed with their track record and the backgrounds. And so was very confident that there's something really big that could come out of this.
So then what happened next year?
So I stayed on at Cavium for 10 years. 4 years into the company's existence, we took it public. So I was part of the management team that took the company public on NASDAQ in 2007. That timing worked out well because 2008 is when the big crash happened. And we build a very broad portfolio of networking processors, of multi-core processors, of security processors. And we made a massive impact on the internet. So we built chips that drove over 90% of e-commerce through SSL accelerators. We built chips that drove majority of the VPNs, that powered a lot of the VPNs. We built chips that powered a lot of mobile infrastructure, you know, on 3G, 4G, and then later on even with 5G networks. So Cavium played, I think, a very pivotal role, a very high impact role in making the internet what it is today, and continues to do so. Again, I stayed on for 10 years. Most recently, I was the chief operating officer at Cavium. Cavium continued to grow very well, eventually ended up hitting $1 billion in annual revenues. We had a multi-billion dollar IPO on NASDAQ, and eventually Cavium was acquired for greater than $6 billion by Marvell, another large, successful infrastructure provider.
And obviously someone that you ended up knowing very well, because your next company, you sold it to them too. So so one thing here that I thought it was really interesting, you know, as part of your journey is that eventually you decide, you know, that you wanted to take a look at what it looked like to being on the other side of the table. So how was that, you know, via Moment Ventures? I mean, how was it like, you know, like to, you know, put some tickets into founders that you thought, you know, were into something interesting?
Yeah, I mean, Moment was an excellent experience. I mean, the idea was that work was changing and it was becoming, you know, software as a service was an important trend that had happened, again, driven by the internet infrastructure that we had enabled. Software as a service and other applications like e-commerce and video started to become prominent on the cloud. And so the idea was, can we help entrepreneurs to build applications, you know, fund them and so forth? And so that was the theme that Moment has and continues to have. Moment is an early stage, seed stage and Series A stage venture capital fund firm in Silicon Valley. But through my experience at Moment, what I saw was it gave me the opportunity to look at hundreds, maybe even 1,000 different startup founders pitching their companies. And, you know, through that process, obviously these guys are passionate, driven, great ideas. But you also see who are folks that have the potential to build a successful business versus people that are technologists or really need more work to figure out, right? And so as you watch, lots and lots of entrepreneurs, you learn a lot about this. And in that process, you meet a lot of people. And through that process is how I met my co-founder for the next company, Innovium.
So let's talk about that. How did you guys meet and why did you thought it makes sense to jump in, you know, with him and to make it happen? Because Innovium was quite a success.
Yes, it was. And again, the theme that I have, if you string it all together, is, you know, friendships, relationships, and great teams, right? And that's really the basic idea. So just completely by chance, I met one of my friends who was who I knew from my undergraduate days in computer science at IIT at a restaurant in Silicon Valley. And we hadn't kept in touch, but we ran into each other. And we said, okay, let's catch up and so forth. And we met a few months later and we said, is there an opportunity? You know, as a VC, my standard line that I would use again and again was, hey, what are you doing in a big company? You ought to do a startup in Silicon Valley, and that's what Silicon Valley is all about. And so he said, look, I work in a company called Broadcom. It's a large company. People had become scared of investing in brand new semiconductor startups. So it really doesn't make sense to do that. But he was interested. So he was one of my co-founders, Puneet Agarwal. We said, okay, let's give it a shot. Let's go find and see if there would be other VCs that would have the fortitude to bet on a semiconductor startup, right? Let's bring Silicon back into Silicon Valley type of a theme. We tried it, and over a few months, we found some people that were willing to take a bet on the people. The basic idea we saw was that as the infrastructure was transitioning from enterprises and telcos to the cloud, there was an opportunity to build a product that was from the ground up. It was cloud optimized, if you will, for networking. And so we said, let's build a company, let's put together a team. And again, a lot of folks from Broadcom, just a super talented team. So there we found some VCs who were willing to bet on the team, the opportunity, and the vision we had. And we really didn't have a product idea when we got this started. But once it got started, it took a life of its own.
Yeah, no kidding. How much capital did you guys raise over the course of the life of the business, which was about 7 years?
We raised north of $300 million for Innovium. We started out building a chip in a leading process technology node. The chip is, you know, one of the biggest chips in the semiconductor space, you know, many, many billions of transistors in a single device. It was the very fastest chip in terms of bandwidth in the world. And we were targeting very large cloud customers as cloud companies, hyperscale companies as customers. And so we had to not just build a chip, but also put together a tremendous amount of software around it. So it took a lot of capital to get to the first product, but we were able to not just execute on it, but win some really big name customers. That allowed us to raise more money and kind of ramp up our revenues.
Hey, guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard, and already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com. And we would love to take a look at helping you out.
And now in your case, I mean, you've raised quite a bit of money, you know, throughout your career. In fact, we're going to be having a nice, news that you're going to be, you know, breaking here today with all of us. And we'll get that in just a little bit with your latest company, right? Now, and that is with Aradin. Now, before we get there, you know, you've raised, you know, a lot of money during your journey as an entrepreneur. What would you say are the three biggest stakes that you've taken, you know, from that success in raising all that money that you think, you know, could be very helpful for all the founders that are listening to us right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've raised approximately $500 million, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $500 million through my career. And I've raised funding from early stage investors, mid stage investors, late stage investors, also been involved in an IPO, have interacted with investors representing public company, you know, mutual fund and hedge fund investors. So the takeaway obviously is slightly different depending on the stage of the company and the type of investors you're dealing with. In the early stage of the company, investors are really looking for people who are ideally, obviously, people who have the track record and the experience and some domain expertise, especially in hard tech or deep tech or infrastructure areas where it requires a lot of upfront capital. That is an important element of it. So some domain knowledge is very critical. Having a strong team that can execute is very critical. You know, alignment with some big secular theme is an important aspect of it. So, you know, today, for example, if you're trying to build a hardware product shipping into SMBs, VCs are not interested in that, right? But if you're working on AI or if you're working on security for cloud and edge applications, that's a attractive area to be in. So the type of market, those are all very important attributes in the early stage. As you go to mid stage and late stage, people always look for proof points. And so timing it right is very critical. I mean, the one thing I believe is I really don't talk to VCs about funding unless I have hit a few milestones and I can very concretely point out what has been achieved since the previous fundraising round, and also being very clear in what this funding round will deliver going forward. And so as you get later, obviously, the product, the customer, the technology, the patents, the revenue forecasts become much, much more important. And to be able to articulate the vision along with all of that is critical as part of fundraising.
So in this case, you know, going back to Innovium, you know, tremendous, tremendous outcome. You know, the company ended up being acquired for 1.2 billion at the time of the closing, you know, ended up being 1.3 billion because it was done in stock. But walk us through how that transaction happened. I mean, how did that transaction come about? And why did you guys thought that doing it in stock, it was the way to go? Because obviously doing it in stock, it's a tremendous risk. I mean, cash is king, you know, stock, you never know what's going to happen, but walk us through it.
I mean, you know, we had a great product, we had great customers, we had revenues that were ramping. And so our original vision was to obviously build another standalone public IPO company. But a few things got in the way. One was obviously the fact that COVID and the pandemic hit, and we were impacted by supply chain limitations. And some of our big customers wanted assurance of supply, if you will. And so they kind of steered us in the direction of a potential acquirer, if you will. And during that process, as we were talking to folks, maybe to help us with supply, if you will, we started talking to a bunch of big companies. And through that discussion, there was mutual interest between us and Marvell in trying to explore a potential acquisition. And so that's how the thing got triggered. We were, by the way, also looking for a follow-on round of funding right around the same time. And so we had plenty of cash, and we had an alternative path had the M&A not happened. But we were able to come to a reasonable deal between Marvell and us that worked out well for them, for us, as well as for our employees and investors. You know, taking an acquisition price in stock was something obviously Marvell was interested in. And we did a due diligence to see that, you know, was Marvell stock a good stock, right? So we did some some homework, if you will, to make sure that we felt comfortable with that. And then also what happened is that typically when you do these acquisitions, the time from the agreement to the close of the acquisition is something, if it's very long, it introduces higher risk. Now, in our case, obviously, because we had we were a private company, didn't have to get certain approvals, for example, international approvals for our acquisition, it went much faster. So what we tried to do was obviously try to minimize the risk, but we felt good given the supply chain limitations that Marvell had a very good pipeline of revenues going forward. They also had a great strategy that aligned with the thinking that we had. And so that made us much more comfortable in taking Marvell stock and actually worked out very well.
No kidding. Now, $1.3 billion. I mean, that's absolutely incredible. Now, in your case, you know, hey, you don't stop. You know, why? I mean, after a $1.3 billion, you know, exit, you know, I would envision you taking it easy, you know, reading books, having margaritas, you know, at the beach, you know, something exciting. Why going at it again?
Yeah, I mean, again, it's I kind of look at it as by chance, if you will. I took some time off, really had a good time. But as I started to help folks, my thinking was, let me help some folks get companies off the ground. And I, in that process, got in touch with my co-founder at Auradine, Barun Kar. Barun is a person who I know because Palo Alto Networks was a customer of ours at Cavium, in my Cavium days. And Palo Alto Networks, as you know, has done an incredible job in building a leader in the security space with multiple tens of billions of dollars in valuation. Barun has been with Palo Alto from the founding days, and he was looking to get a company off the ground, and we connected, and as we started to look at it, the theme was again very similar. We think infrastructure is going to evolve. There are new technologies that will create some very powerful improvements in the infrastructure that will again unlock a lot of applications on top of it. And we saw blockchain and we saw security and privacy as some super attractive technologies and some incredible applications on top of it that we said, let's do this again. And can we build a company that has the potential of being a standalone industry leader in this space? So the idea was, again, we had a team, you know, a number of folks from Palo Alto. We also have a number of folks from Cavium. So people that we all know that have incredible talent and a track record addressing a market that's very massive. We were able to raise a significant round to go after our vision here. And so that kind of created an opportunity that was very compelling to do it again and see if we can be even more successful than we have been in the past.
So I guess in this case, for the people that are listening to get it, what ended up being the business model of the company? How do you guys make money?
So some of my prior companies were about silicon. And what we would do is we would build silicon products and sell it to companies that would either build systems or that would operate cloud networks or cloud infrastructure. Here, what we are doing is we have assembled a team that actually has talents across many areas. So it's talents across silicon, across security, software as a service, as well as systems. So our plan here is to not actually sell silicon, but to sell system level or cloud level solutions. So what we intend to do is, depending on the customer and the application area, we'll either sell complete systems and software managed through a cloud API and cloud interface. Or in other cases, it will be kind of a software as a service model to deliver our products.
So for you guys now, you know, there is a big announcement that you'd like to share when it comes to fundraising. What has happened in fundraising? What's the big news, Rajiv?
Yeah, the big news today, we are announced the fact that we have raised $81 million in Series A financing for next generation web infrastructure. Our financing has been led this time by Mayfield and Celesta, which are two of the top Silicon Valley venture firms, along with strategic investors, Stanford University, and a variety of other investors. Our focus, again, is infrastructure. We want to build, for the next generation infrastructure, we want to build highly scalable, secure, and sustainable solutions.
But I mean, that's $81 million. It's a lot of money on a Series A. Series A typically is 5 to 15 with a median average of 10. So why so much money?
So much money because, and you know, as you saw that we raised this money, the market is not the best market for fundraising. VC capital is down. What we wanted to do was, and we were able to get it, right? And we have customers who are part of this funding round. We felt like we are in a window of time with raising interest rates, with some level of uncertainty on the economy, that it was better to raise more upfront to be able to go longer, if you will, to deliver the complete product. And then we are doing leading edge process technology, silicon, which is expensive as well. So that was really the driving factor behind taking more capital earlier in this round. And of course, we were able to get an attractive valuation to enable that as well.
I mean, obviously, with your background, you know, after having sold your company for $1.3 billion, you know, I'm sure that people were throwing money at you, Rajiv.
Yeah, I mean, look, can't complain. And you know, I certainly am very grateful to the investors and the VCs that have the faith and the trust in not just my abilities, but the team's abilities.
Well, no doubt they're very lucky, you know, to be able to invest in what I would consider a tier zero founder, you know, those ones that they are very difficult to come by. Now, in your case, you know, and for the team too, obviously, you know, to those investors, you had to share a vision. So let's see what you have to share here. Imagine you go to sleep tonight, Rajiv, and you wake up in a world where the vision, you know, the company is fully realized. What does that world look like?
Yeah, I think that the technologies that we're building that include blockchain, that include AI, that include privacy, over the next 5 to 10 years will have a multiple $1 trillion impact on the global economy and the IT. And the way I look at it is that, you know, if you look at the history of the technology industry, we started obviously with mainframes that was very centralized, went to PCs that were, you know, more decentralized, went to cloud, which is quite centralized, if you will. And now we are moving into edge and IoT applications. But we live in a world where there are a few companies that have that control a lot of our data and monetize it. I think it is time that people have more power. Individuals, creators have more power, that they have more economic share of what they're doing. We also are moving into a world where privacy is becoming more and more important. You know, various companies, including Apple and Google, have privacy initiatives. But privacy is hard, and there's a trade-off between privacy and security where the government gets very nervous if everything is private because then they can't enforce laws and can't enforce regulation. So I think we will have some very attractive technologies that will come out that will enable a number of applications that will drive greater decentralization, will drive greater privacy, will have massive, massive impact. So again, we are not announcing a product at this time, but we intend to do a product announcement later this year that will make things a little more clear.
Wonderful. So now, if you had the opportunity of going back in time and you were able to go back in time to that moment where you were still, you know, doing your studies, you know, perhaps the PhD and wondering, you know, what will be the professional career, especially the entrepreneurial journey. And you were able to go back in time and give yourself one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
You know, I thought, so this is what I kind of think about from time to time. You know, I personally think that things that have worked well and things I might have done differently, if you will. Overall, I don't have much to complain about. You know, the things that have worked well are the relationships, the friendships, the you know, the learnings through all these experiences. What I think I would have done is I would have taken a risk a little earlier than I did. You know, so my first startup that I joined was in 1998. The internet had started in 1995, and there was a lot of exciting things that happened. And so I would have done things a little earlier. That's number one. I think the other thing that I would have, you know, I would have done is when I was growing up, and certainly through my college days, I was a very introvert guy. I really didn't see the value of networking and building relationships until a little bit later. I would have done that also earlier in life. So I would say those are two things, if I had done earlier, that would have been very useful.
I love it. So, Rajiv, for the people that are listening, that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Well, they can certainly reach out to me on LinkedIn and connect. That's one way. You know, I'll put my email address. Don't promise I will respond to everybody, but my email address is very simple. It is Khemani, which is my last name, @gmail.com. So those are two ways to get in touch with me.
Amazing. Well, Rajiv, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Alejandro. Pleasure is entirely mine.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.